Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
We are working to maximize the authorities we have and the tools we have, and when the facts changed and the circumstances changed, we changed the strategy. We didn't implement a flawed strategy. We implemented a strategy that worked.
That, of course, is Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. And if you're getting the impression that they're making it up as they go along in the so-called $700 billion rescue package on Capitol Hill, you may be right, because there's a broad consensus among economists that there is no real playbook for this kind of financial crisis, that making it up as you go along maybe is the best strategy. Paulson was on the Hill yesterday along with Ben Bernanke of the Federal Reserve talking about the progress of freeing up credit markets and whether or not some of this money should go to bail out the auto industry. Joining us now is Amity Schlaes. She's the author of The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. Thanks so much for coming into the studio and being with us.
Good morning.
And I got your name right, correct?
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely right. So, let's talk about the predicament of Henry Paulson up there. I mean, he's basically got to convey to Congress that the rules are changing, that it is a fluid situation. What do you make of how he is changing the rules and the strategy that he seems to have adopted here?
Well, all along, many observers had thought that it might be better for him to infuse capital into these companies than buy their troubled assets, because that basically lets them off free and also takes control of them when you buy up someone's assets. There was a sense that Washington was being forced to move to take over New York, and New York was being forced to move to Washington. So that shift is okay, but there is no clarity here. Why is it that Detroit doesn't get and Wall Street does? And that's a question for all of us.
Well, before we talk about the auto industry, I want to discuss the psychological components of this. The lending in the commercial credit markets seems to have freed up a little bit, it unfrozen. And Bernanke is correct in saying that interest rates are coming down and that banks are starting to lend and the commercial paper market is sort of coming back. What's going to bring other sectors of lending back? Because it is a psychological question of, do you feel like you should lend? Do you feel like it's safe to lend a million here, a couple of million there?
It's not totally psychological. It's also, what are the prospects for growth in the United States? And if you do things that make the prospects for growth much stronger, then you will see all the problems fade.
Remember, like what?
Like what? Well, there are different ways to do it. One way to do it is to make the U.S. more relatively attractive to invest in. And there's an idea that no one is going to talk about now because it's politically very hard, which is you reduce capital gains taxes. You reduce the corporate tax. One of the reasons we're in trouble now is vis-a-vis London, we're less attractive than we used to be.
What does that mean in terms of money that we are not seeing that is going to London instead? And one of the criticisms of the kind of tax cut you're talking about is it is definitely not targeted at the broadest sort of consumer middle class.
Absolutely. That means is you have initial public offerings in London instead of here. Companies start there. Sometimes they create jobs there or elsewhere and not here. So you want to look what will cause job creation in addition to the other things people are talking about. And it's a big omission in the discussion because we're not in the 1950s. We're not in a vacuum where the rest of the world is on its back and we are the only economy. We are competing. And that's the part of the story that doesn't seem to get into the hearings at this moment.
In terms of the notion that we are competing because it is such a global market, thinking about the actions of the Treasury Secretary, I've heard some people describe them as erratic. And one thing markets hate, as we all know, is uncertainty. So this switching of strategy in the middle, while it may be in response to changing facts on the ground, how does that affect the confidence level?
We have very serious uncertainty right now. Exactly. And uncertainty is bad for markets. Markets hate unknown unknowns. And from the beginning, the arbitrary aspect of the Treasury bailout has frightened a lot of observers. Well, where did they get that 700 number? Why are they reducing it to 350 now? Why is it right that Detroit should not be part of it? All these questions are insufficiently answered. What you have actually is in the background two philosophers debating. One is Bagehot, the great UK philosopher who taught that in a crisis you supply liquidity, lend freely, was the adverb that he used. Another is Keynes, whom Paulson was directly quoting, another UK economic philosopher, John Maynard Keynes. He said, when the facts change, I change my plan. What do you do? Are you a stuck-in-the-mud ideologue? Or,
so, well, Keynes was also an advocate of spending,
right,
on the spending side,
exactly,
whereas the not on so much the lending side.
But
a battle of philosophers probably doesn't contribute to a feeling of equanimity on the part of the investors, though, right?
Absolutely.
To see two philosophers battling over billions of dollars makes you want to pull your money out of.
And you know, you see the limits of Bagehot, and you see the limits of Keynes, because after a while, Bagehot's liquidity becomes Keynes's stimulus. And I know this sounds very academic, but that's who they're quoting. It's two big guys.
Bagehot and Keynes. I have all their albums. Phil Graham described the Americans as whiners, and that the recession that we are in is a function of people sort of convincing themselves that things are getting worse rather than better. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's unfair to use a quote from Phil Graham from earlier in the year to now. It's very hard to establish when a recession starts. Technically, when he said that, we were not in a recession. In the second quarter, we had 2% plus growth. Are we in a recession now? Probably. Should we worry about it? Probably not. We know we're in trouble. We need to fix the trouble. To focus on the technical definition of recession is sort of like saying, you know, do I still have a fever or do I not when I'm getting better? Or have I got the fever yet when I know I have the disease?
But forget the fever. Maybe the better question is, do you feel sick? And if you feel sick, that's something that's real. I mean, there's a lot of talk that like psychological negativity is sending the market down. But in fact, psychological positivity was partially responsible for this entire mess to begin with. It's all psychological.
Everyone, I think, understands at this point that there are certain laws and reforms that need to happen to make the U.S. economy be more stable and grow in the future. There are still big uncertainty. For example, Fannie and Freddie, you spoke of uncertainty before. Fannie and Freddie, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the ones who really set off the crisis in the view of a lot of us early in September when they went to the government, that hasn't been resolved. And the essential uncertainty of Fannie and Freddie was they were hybrids. They were half government, half market. They were traded, but they had this implicit government guarantee. And so that is still, you know,
those monsters could rear their heads,
right,
again, is what you're saying.
They're part of the government now, but they're still problematic.
And it's $5 trillion in assets that are backed at,
right,
Fannie and Freddie. What are you watching on that front, then, that might emerge between now and then early next year?
Will they make room for the private sector to move in here? This is related to me. I look at Detroit and say, what are they doing for them? And there are two kinds of things you can do for Michigan. One is you can just give them money out of the big package. That's what we're hearing in Washington. But another is you can do a set of things to help Michigan people find new jobs because their industry is a dinosaur, such as give their children full tuition to Michigan State and Ann Arbor. Give them enormous packages to finish their lives in a positive way, to go back to school, to have good pensions. It's possible to buy those people a good future without perpetuating the subsidy machine to the automakers. And you're not hearing a lot of that either. You're just hearing spend, spend, spend.
Is there a track record for those kinds of retraining programs? I mean, they're very interesting as you're proposing them there. And those are great schools, Michigan State and U of M.
Yeah, I think the U of M is a most excellent school.
What I mean is this is a finite number of people, 3 million. It sounds huge, but it's finite. We have actually discussed this quite a bit vis-a-vis farms, because farms and autos are the same. They get subsidy. Oil doesn't. It's just different industries. And when you buy off the farmer and you give his child an inheritance, then you also make a deal. I won't have to subsidize you and your grandchildren forever just because you call yourself farmer in America as a romantic connection with farms or autos. And so where is that package? If we're going to be spending hundreds of billions, that one should be there too.
And do you think we're going to lose one or two car makers? We're sort of asking everyone that this morning.
I think we're going to lose two.
That's what Alex Taylor said.
I know.
Fortune
we're two
magazine.
For two today.
Two for two today.
Your reason is because?
Because they are just not competitive. And because of all the other demands for the table, the liquidity demand, right? Many, many demands on the table.
Right. They've got all kinds of restructuring costs that are absolutely built in, including labor costs. Amity Schles, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Amity Schles is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. She's the author of The Forgotten Man, The New History of the Great Depression. We want you to think about stories of debt and debt management and your relationship with your banker. Elizabeth Warren is coming up. She's a law professor at Harvard who specializes in consumer bankruptcy and commercial law. You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Debt management, your relationship with your banker, making the banking business better. All that for our guests.